Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, November 22nd, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with our colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Mises-Tan and from WCAI and Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times. We'll check in with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll speak with WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. And now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Kristen, the town of Dennis has received a letter from the American Civil Liberties Union taking issue with a policy that calls for random searches of beach coolers.
Yes, so Dennis officials actually held a closed-doors discussion Tuesday of that policy, and that discussion was prompted by a letter from the American Civil Liberties Union, which called the policy a violation of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and the ACLU actually requested that the policy be suspended. In the letter, an ACLU attorney wrote that the ACLU had concerns regarding the constitutionality of the town of Dennis's policy and practice of requiring people to submit to warrantless and suspicionless searches of their coolers and their bags as a condition of entry to town beaches. They asked that the town take immediate action to suspend the policy and practice to avoid continued deprivation of constitutional rights.
Tell us how this policy came about, because this is relatively new in the last couple of years.
So in the past couple of years, Dennis has been really cracking down on alcohol consumption at its beaches in an effort to restore a more family-friendly atmosphere there. And this was all sort of spurred by an infamous July 4th, 2017 incident in which some teenagers were seen allegedly drunk and having sex in plain view at Mayflower Beach. That incident, along with urging from Dennis residents who reported other instances of sort of raucous or law-breaking behavior, led the Dennis Board of Selectmen to establish a temporary beach safety and monitoring committee. And that committee was charged with addressing those safety and traffic concerns. The committee met for several months and eventually recommended a $500,000 plan that actually called for stationing 20 monitors at beach entrances to check coolers for alcohol and for an increased police presence at town beaches. The board stopped short of approving that full plan, but ultimately five monitors were hired for the 2018 beach season. An additional three were hired for this past 2019 season. The policy has earned sort of praise from some residents for restoring a more wholesome atmosphere to town beaches. People have said, you know, now I feel more comfortable bringing my kids there, my family there. I don't have to worry about this sort of out-of-control behavior. Others have said, though, that the policy is kind of an overreaction and an overreach. And the ACLU's stance is that the policy violates state and federal laws. The organization's letter stated that state and federal courts have approved warrantless and suspicionless searches only when the government's interest involves a significant threat to public safety. And they gave the example of searches, for example, for explosives or weapons at government buildings or airports. The letter also goes on to argue that random searches aren't really necessary because the town could sort of just take a look at what's happening on the beach and single out individuals who might be causing a problem.
So they really are drawing this distinction here between searching the coolers and bags for alcohol and something like searching for explosives entering a public building, saying that this is just not on the same order of magnitude, and the town has other ways to address this problem.
Yeah, the letter said that presumably the town's beach entry searches for alcohol, and this is a quote, are not aimed at protecting public safety against such catastrophic dangers as airplane hijackings, major train accidents, or acts of terrorism or mass violence. The letter also said that town officials can detect persons who are consuming or possessing alcohol on the beach just by observing and monitoring, and then possibly search those individuals' coolers and bags based on their suspicious activities, rather than just searching everyone's bag as a prerequisite to getting onto the beach. I did speak with the Dennis chair of the Board of Selectmen on Wednesday morning, and he said that they did have this closed-door discussion of the policy on Tuesday, but that no action was taken and no votes were taken on the policy. So it looks like we'll sort of have to wait and see whether this policy will be in effect next summer as well, or if they'll try to find a different way to kind of approach keeping things in control at the beaches.
Now we are joined by WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And Sarah, a number of offshore wind companies came together with an announcement this week detailing a proposal for a uniform turbine layout. So what is this thing, a uniform turbine layout, and what are these companies hoping to accomplish with it?
Sure, yeah. The uniform turbine layout is a bit of a mouthful to say, and also it's essentially a pre-agreed-upon layout of offshore wind turbines that the five offshore wind companies that have already won lease areas in New England waters say they'll use when they begin construction. So they were hoping to address a lot of concerns that have come up from the Coast Guard and from fishing groups that have stated that previous turbine layouts, like what Vineyard Wind proposed, would hinder safety operations in the area. And so essentially they agreed upon 1 mile by 1 nautical mile spacing between the turbines, and also an east-west orientation of turbine rows and north-south orientation in columns.
Who are the companies and why these companies?
The companies are Eversource, Mayflower Wind, Ørsted, Vineyard Wind, and Equinor, all company names that if you've been following the offshore wind industry closely, like we have, they should all sound familiar because they've all won lease areas off the coast of Massachusetts.
These are the players in New England, essentially, down to Rhode Island and Connecticut. Mm-hmm. We heard some pushback on this from the fishing industry. Tell us what it is that they see about this plan that concerns them.
Yeah, fishing groups, particularly the midwater trawlers, who are part of the squid fishery in Rhode Island, say they're still not happy about this arrangement. To them, you know, they said the orientation of turbines doesn't really affect them. What they're most worried about is that mile-wide spacing between the turbines, which they say is very unsafe. They were a little frustrated because they say they've been saying this for a while now in comment groups. They say that even with the smaller turbines that are currently being used on Block Island, the radar interference that these smaller turbines give off extends 1.5 miles on both sides. And so that would leave less than 1 mile for ships to navigate through, essentially, if you kind of can visualize that mm-hmm. in your head. And they say this isn't even accounting for potential radar interference that could come from the larger turbines that these companies are considering.
So what happens next with all of this? And where does it go from here?
They say they'll be looking to offer their comments to the Coast Guard soon, although there isn't really any specific firm timeline. As we know, Vineyard Wind's project has been stalled by the federal government. And so these projects are all kind of in a holding pattern at this point.
That is WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve.
We're going to go back to Kristen Young now. Kristen, do we have you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I hear you loud and clear. Kristen, a number of Cape towns have received subpoenas about the agreements they negotiated with marijuana businesses. Now, we have some information this week about how the towns are handling those subpoenas and what's expected of them.
Yes, so Provincetown, Wellfleet, Eastham, Brewster, and Mashpee were among several towns statewide to receive subpoenas from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Massachusetts, and those subpoenas ordered them to testify or forward all paperwork related to the host agreements by the grand jury's November 14th hearing date. They did later get an extension to that deadline to December 5th. And it, really, these host agreements, since recreational marijuana retailers have to work out these host agreements with their target communities before they can get state licenses, there's been concern that those agreements can become tools for communities to make these exorbitant demands. For example, Fall River Mayor Hazel Correa was arrested last month for allegedly extorting marijuana companies for the chance to do business in the city. And under state law, communities can actually charge an annual impact fee of up to 3% of the company's gross sales for up to 5 years. And that fee is supposed to defray the cost that the town must bear for hosting those businesses. For example, they might have more demand on their police and fire departments or on road infrastructure, so that 3% charge would help cover those costs. But many town host agreements actually do include other charges. Brewster, for example, has 3 host agreements. And they have included the impact fee as well as a $25,000 annual community benefit payment and a charitable donation of about $15,000. In Provincetown, recreational marijuana retailers are charged the annual 3% impact fee with an additional 1% to go toward grants for local nonprofit organizations and charities. License holders must also pledge 100 hours of community service. And the court is not only looking for the agreements, but also for these earlier drafts, along with all written communications regarding the documents. And that really translates to a lot of work for these towns in terms of pulling together all the required materials, especially considering that several of the towns do have more than one host agreement.
And the court is also looking for information about businesses that applied but did not get the host agreements. So it's not only these businesses that have worked out host agreements and all the information around that, but the information about the agreements that didn't get chosen and selected. So you can see, you can imagine it's a huge amount of paperwork for some of these small towns to pull together.
Yeah, that's true. One of the lawyers who's representing some of these towns said that, you know, the more businesses you have, the larger the volume of paperwork, and that the towns are working diligently to comply, but, you know, going through every single email and every single draft and making sure that you really pull everything together is quite a bit of work.
One of the other things that this story sort of points out is that there's such a range across the Cape here of how towns are handling the marijuana agreements. We have plenty of towns, particularly across the Upper Cape, with no host agreements because they haven't welcomed marijuana, recreational marijuana into the town. And then you have towns like Provincetown with seven individual host agreements with businesses.
Yeah, and that disparity is really going to, you know, put the burden on more on some towns than others. Like you mentioned, Provincetown, seven agreements, all these different drafts and iterations. Wellfleet also has five host agreements. So even Mashpee, they only have one recreational license that they've agreed to give out. But several applicants have approached the town to discuss host agreements. So all of that paperwork still has to be submitted, even though they're only going to be licensing one establishment.
It's also interesting that the town of Truro, which has this marijuana craft cooperative, apparently was not served a subpoena to deliver information about that.
Yeah, they said that, you know, I think they said they would have been ready to comply with that, but that town, they have a cooperative there called High Dune. They're moving forward. They didn't receive a subpoena regarding the host agreement with the growers there.
Let's turn to a story in today's paper, Kristen. This is about the effort to make highways across the country more uniform. It's a federal law that's looking to do this, and it may force some big changes for Route 6 across the Cape. But the changes would only be to the names of exits. But even so, that's too much, a lot of people are saying.
Yeah, the Cape and Islands legislative delegation has actually asked the Massachusetts Department of Transportation to look at an exemption to this federal highways program that requires all interstates and freeways across the country to convert from sequentially numbered exits, such as 1 through 12 for Route 6 that we're all sort of familiar with here, to a milepost-based system that counts distance from the most western or southern point for each highway in a state. And the argument that our legislative delegation has here is that this would really be quite confusing if we applied it to Route 6. In the case of Route 6, the western starting point is at the Rhode Island border in Seekonk, where Route 6 diverges from Interstate 195 and becomes a two-lane road known as Highland Avenue. That circles behind a mall and dips south toward the Cape. And for the most of its length, Route 6 is actually more of a suburban thoroughfare than an interstate highway. And only this short 34 miles on the Cape is considered a limited access highway with controlled entrances and exits that are restricted to ramps.
So, let me just jump in here. So, what it really means is that by the time it gets to the Cape, where it really turns into a highway, Route 6, the first exit on the Cape would no longer be exit 1, it would be exit 55.
Yeah, I think it was exit 55, and then the next one would be 59, and then the final one down at Orleans would be exit 89. So here, yeah, people would you know, who are used to this very sort of west through east, 1 through 12 system of numbering exits, it would be quite confusing to change that up to a system of 55 through 59.
A number of people taking issue with this, including the State House delegation. Tell us about that.
Yeah, State Senator Julian Sear said he thought this was a stupid idea when he heard about it before he was elected, but he still hasn't heard of a good reason why they're doing this, except for the threat of withholding federal dollars. Now, the Federal Highway Administration is requiring this for, you know, highways across the country, but there's also the argument made that it's sort of an outdated effort, that, you know, people now are mostly navigating using their cell phones, and that, you know, it doesn't necessarily make sense to switch to, especially for this section of highway, new exits that would require new signs and, you know, quite a bit of work. It's a project that, you know, would require quite a bit of work to be installed.
Wendy Northcross at the Cape Cod Times kind of saying that as a general thing, this seems unnecessary and she's not in favor of it, but that mostly it would have an impact probably on locals more than on visitors.
Yeah, she thinks residents might be more put out by these renumbered exits than visitors. She's the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce.
Cape Cod Chamber, I said the Times.
You know, there's also this idea that I think that our legislative delegation was initially told that this is a federal mandate, so Massachusetts can't opt out of this. But also, according to MassDOT's website, four other highways in the state have already been granted exemptions, and those include Route 213, Interstate 291, Interstate 391, and the Lowell Connector.
I want to turn to one more story before we let you go, and it's about a man who's been a fixture of police on Cape Cod. He's outgoing. He's very much a spokesman around police-related issues, and he's announced he'll be retiring. This is Stephen Exaros.
Yes, Exaros has been a fixture at the Yarmouth Police Department for more than 40 years. He's currently the deputy police chief, but he's served in many roles throughout his time at the department, including detective, school resource officer, and patrol first commander. And Yarmouth Police Chief Frank Fredrickson have sort of built up. They have this relationship together because they started their full-time careers with the YPD on the same day in 1979.
That's amazing. Yes.
Yeah, that long ago, they served as summer officers together for the town, and then kind of started these careers together. So Chief Fredrickson said that he's really going to miss Exaros. He said he's a dynamic individual and a very caring person, and has a heart to help everybody. He's also been quite a personality on the Yarmouth Police Department. He's been well known for maintaining this high profile for advocacy of community policing initiatives, involvement in leadership in community and charitable organizations, and social media acumen. He's kind of built up this YPD Facebook page that has, you know, quite a number of viewers, and they all tend to tune in when Exaros makes a post. And he was also there, you know, he's been struck with tragedy twice throughout his career at the Yarmouth Police Department. The first was the death of his son, U.S. Marine Corps Corporal Nicholas Exaros. He died from wounds suffered during a combat operation in Afghanistan in 2009. And then there was also, of course, the line of duty shooting of Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon in 2018. And Exaros has really used those two things as a reason to go forward and fight for change. He said you can mourn your fallen and go back to normal, or you can make sure it doesn't happen again. Mm.
There's an idea that he may be looking at a political career.
Yes. So the idea here is he's going to be retiring on December 8th, which is his 61st birthday. And the idea here is that it will clear the way for an anticipated run in 2020 for state representative in the 5th Barnstable District, which is a seat being vacated by Representative Randy Hunt of Sandwich. So we can look forward to seeing if that campaign does take off and sort of how he fares there.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times has been Kristen Young. Thank you, Kristen, for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. The Wampanoag tribe of Gay Head Aquinnah held its election this past weekend. It has the potential for big implications for the tribe, and the outcome appears to have been very close. With us to talk about it is Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Bill, tell us, how close was this and who came out ahead?
Well, it was historically close. The election was 78-75, and Cheryl Andrews Maltese, the incumbent tribal chairman, won the re-election. Now, this is a historically close election.
Just three votes. Let me point at that. Just three votes.
I know.
Yes.
Can you imagine? Three votes. So, of course, the challenger, Kevin Devine, has asked for a recount. Now, it's not. We don't know yet whether the recount is going to take place. He has asked for it. Right now, it's still. We haven't had confirmation it's going to take place. In the latest public available information adopted back in 2001, it says if a recount is to take place, it will do so 2 weeks after the Sunday of the election. So there still could be a lot of time, even if they decide to do a recount, before we find out the final winner.
One of the things that was interesting about this is that in order to vote, members of the tribe had to return all the way to the island to vote right there at the community center. They couldn't, and a large number of these people live off island.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. But and just to go back to the actual vote tally, 78 to 75, it's a really low turnout, too. There are approximately a little over 1,300 active voting members. Of that, only 319 are registered on the vineyard. So during these elections, it's a three-year term. So every 3 years, there's a lot of buses that come in from people off island, tribal members coming to vote. It took place from noon to 5 on Sunday at the headquarters. So it's a big thing. A lot of folks coming off island to vote. And this year it looks like, just historically low, which was very interesting because there's a lot at stake.
Tell us about that.
Well, the write-in challenger, Kevin Devine, he's a write-in challenger, a political newcomer, so it's really interesting that he was able to mount this close campaign. He was born in the vineyard and spent 27 years in active duty in the Army. And he has said that he is opposed to this movement to build a Class 2 gaming site up in Aquinnah, which has been Ms. Andrews Maltese, that's something she has championed over the years. In 2018, the tribe announced a $10 million partnership with Global Gaming Solutions. That's the gaming arm of the Chickasaw tribe. And then in January 2019, they broke ground on the site, but after that, nothing's really happened. There's a lot of back-and-forth legal wrangling. But so this election really is putting that in play. But again, right now, as it stands, Ms. Andrews Maltese is the winner, but there will be a recount, it looks like, but we don't have confirmation on that.
Before I let you go, I want to give you an opportunity to give a shout-out to one of the sports teams on the island.
Definitely. A huge weekend for the boys' cross-country team. They won the Division II state championships on Saturday, so I want to say congratulations to them. It really is an incredible and amazing victory. On Saturday after the race, it took place at the Gardner Municipal Golf Course off island. Everybody meets them at the ferry. The fire trucks come out and blare the sirens. It really is a great sort of island-style welcome and cheering on to a job, really an incredible job. Well done.
Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Stage Harbor Channel in Chatham is going to be dredged coming up in December. With us to talk about this development is Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, conditions at the channel have really worsened, which has brought this dredging about. Is that right?
That's right. The Army Corps of Engineers dredge Currituck, they were actually scheduled to come to the entrance channel of Stage Harbor this week, but that was delayed. Apparently, the dredge suffered some damage during a job in Cuddy Hunk Harbor and had to return to its home port for repair. But as you said, Steve, it's scheduled to come to Stage Harbor now in the second week in December. And while there's not a lot of boat traffic this time of year, there's quite a few commercial fishermen now using the harbor because of shoaling at Chatham Harbor. And the Coast Guard has pretty much stationed its boats in Stage Harbor as well because of that shoaling. And the Stage Harbor entrance channel has been gradually deteriorating over the course of the summer. But Coastal Resources Director Ted Keon tells us that during October, remember we had several coastal storms, that really played havoc with the entrance channel, pushed a lot of sand into it. What's kind of happening is that the South Beach along the Atlantic side of Chatham has been deteriorating rapidly, breaking up, and a lot of that sand is being pushed by the tides and currents to the west through the Morris Island Monomoy cut through, and it's all coming towards the Stage Harbor Channel. If you look at aerial photos, you'll see just a fan of sand heading towards that channel. And Stage Harbor is probably Chatham's busiest recreational port during the summer, certainly. So keeping that channel open is really a priority.
Tell us about the dredging that they're planning now, and how long do they think this is going to take, and what's their plan for it?
The plan is basically to clear those shoals from the entrance channel and restore it to its, 9 or 10 foot depth. And according to to coastal resources officials, it's going to take about 3 weeks for them to do that work. One of the downsides of the Currituck doing the work, actually, is that, as you may or may not know, the Currituck's a hopper dredge. It sucks the sand up into a large open well in the vessel, and then they dump it offshore. That's different from a hydraulic dredge like the Barnstable County dredges, which pump the sand through a long pipeline up onto the beaches. And that's been pretty important for Chatham's Nantucket Sound side beaches in the last couple of years because they've been suffering some heavy erosion. And the Barnstable County dredge was supposed to do this particular work last winter, but it broke down and they weren't able to do that work. So the boaters were able to get through the summer, but the channel is just so shoaled up that the Army Corps is coming in. It's a federal Stage Harbor is a federally maintained channel, so it's pretty much the responsibility of the federal government to do that when it's needed. And the town was able to get William Keating, our representative, to help get the Corps in to do that work, so that it would be guaranteed to be done in time for the summer season. Now the question is going to be, of course, if we get a lot of winter storms, some of that work could fill in by the summer, but mm-hmm. The project had to be squeezed in when the Corps could do it. So at least it's going to get done, and hopefully it'll hold up until the boating season.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Steve.
A parcel of beach land in Truro has been purchased by the Truro Conservation Trust. With us to talk about why the trust bought it instead of the town, which originally wanted it, and what the deal could mean for public beach access, is Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Tell us about this parcel of land and this new deal to buy it by the trust.
Yeah, we were very surprised when we were looking at the real estate transactions for Barnstable County on November 1st. The sale of a 1.1-acre bayshore property was sold to the Conservation Trust for $250,000. And we recognized the address immediately. It was the same property that went before town meeting, I think, last year for $869,000. $100,000, and it was this beautiful property that was going to be a combined purchase between the Truro Conservation Trust and the town. And the thought was that the town would contribute funds, and this would triple the size of the public beach there. It's right next to Great Hollow Beach, a lovely bay beach. And then what happened was the town's attorney did research and discovered that there are neighborhood covenants that will prevent that beach from being a so-called technically public beach. So the attorney determined that the town should not be involved in buying it because that was part of the original pitch at town meeting that this would expand the public beach. And so that happened.
The price of this piece of land, though, is nowhere near what the original asking price was.
No, $869,000 was the last thing we had heard until we saw the sale go through for $250,000.
Just $250,000 for this piece of beachfront land.
Yes, yes. It was very surprising. And the only explanation that we got from Fred Gechter from the Conservation Trust is that the previous owners, just decided to sell it at a really good price. It was originally on the market for over $1 million years ago when the trust first started looking at it, and the price came down to around $600,000 at one point, and then the Conservation Trust was offered it for $250,000, which is amazing.
And what will the beach access be like now with the Conservation Trust holding it?
Okay, so it will remain at status quo, meaning people can go to the Great Hollow Beach, which is a town public beach, and at some point that just turns into the Conservation Trust beach, which they are able to preserve as status quo, not public beach, but no trespassing signs or barriers of any kind. So you can walk across it. You can probably put your blanket on it. You can probably do just as you had done before without worrying about barriers. but it's not officially an expanded town beach. And this kind of all came, was highlighted because when the town was all talking very publicly about buying that, neighbors at 4 Killdevil Road said, we're going to put up no trespassing signs. We don't think this should be a public beach, and we're going to enforce the covenants. So this is maybe why this all went down this way, but who knows? In other words, I guess the bottom line is that whole beach area is going to remain just as it was previously, and the Conservation Trust will preserve that buildable beachfront lot from development forever in perpetuity.
It's Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. We're going to speak now with Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard-Times. Good morning, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Jeanette, you've got a fun and interesting story about the intersection of New Bedford scallops and some new technology, which may help people learn where exactly their seafood is coming from. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this was a fun one. A lot of your listeners probably know and have heard in the last few years, there have been a number of studies about how many fish are mislabeled, whether mistakenly or fraudulently, at restaurants and markets. Frequently, you know, a cheaper fish is substituted and so forth. So between that and kind of the whole farm-to-table movement and more people wanting to know where their food comes from, this product and service is designed to allow the consumer to know exactly where the fish came from by scanning a QR code. That's one of those little squares that you scan with a camera on your phone right on your restaurant menu. In this case, it's sort of debuting this particular product or technology at one restaurant chain with one New Bedford fishing boat. And Venture, which is based in New Bedford, yeah.
And you went to the fishing boat and you spoke with the folks who work on the boat, and they kind of showed you how this whole system starts with them processing the scallops while they're still at sea, and they're tagging it, which is the first step, which will of embedding the information that's going to follow these scallops all the way until they arrive on somebody's plate.
So the scallops come on board just as usual. They get shucked, washed, weighed, washed and brought down into the hold. And we actually have a visual of this, a little video on our website, but down in the hold in the usual way, they get bagged, put on the scale, and then the data about where they are is printed onto a QR tag. So that comes right out of the printer right there, and it gets tagged on the bag. So they know the exact latitude and longitude of where they are. And then, the day that it was caught and the captain who was on duty and all of that sort of information. And where the blockchain comes in, the blockchain technology, is that each stage along the supply chain, from the fisherman to the distributor, I'm sorry, the processor, fish processor first, to the distributor, to the restaurant, each one of those entities enters information into this digitized record, which is the blockchain.
And the blockchain is a digitized record that can't be altered once it's created, so that when you get that information as a consumer at the end, you have some confidence that what it's telling you is the actual path that the seafood took all the way to your plate. Is that right?
Right.
Just
yeah.
For people who aren't familiar with blockchain, yes.
Right. I mean, for myself, too, I'd heard a little bit about blockchain, but I had never seen it used in such a sort of down-to-earth practical application before. So if you scan the menu, which they gave us a sample of what this would look like, I scanned it with my phone and I was able to bring it up. It shows, again, the date it was caught and frozen and the location, the captain. Then it shows the date it was brought to the processor, which in this case is in Fall River. Then after it's processed and packaged there, it goes to the distributor, which in this case is in California, and the restaurant chain. Unfortunately, the one bummer of this story is that the restaurant is actually in California, because it is kind of a high-end product, and that's who they're working with for this project. The blockchain technology here is from IBM, and this is, as far as I know, this is the first boat that this particular technology is being used on.
It's a nice video that goes along with the story on the website. Folks can check that out. Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard-Times and South Coast Today. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. The Oak Bluffs Library will no longer be charging late fees. Brian Dow joins us from the Martha's Vineyard Times to explain how this can be. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Steve.
Brian, this is almost like library heresy. No overdue fines. What's the story here?
Yeah, so this is definitely a new thing that they're implementing at the library. On Tuesday, Allison Malik, who is the library director for Oak Bluffs Public Library, went to Selectmen and asked them for their support in this kind of new initiative. And this came about through a lot of Allison's research into late fines at libraries, and she said that a lot of research shows that late fines actually go towards creating a barrier for the people that really require the library services the most. And she said those people tend to be low-income families or caregivers, and especially children. And each year, last year, fiscal year 19, Oak Bluffs brought in about $4,000 in terms of revenue from late fines.
And that doesn't even go to the library, it turns out.
Yeah, correct. That actually just goes straight to the town's general fund. So it doesn't really that revenue doesn't really affect the library's operating budget at all. It's not something that they count on. So she said because of that and a couple other factors, and she wanted to open up the people's accounts too. So this would essentially give everybody a clean slate. It would take away all late fines that are on record, and it would also unblock all blocked accounts. People will still, there'll still be a due date for books, but there's going to be an automatic renewal. If someone does end up losing a book, they will have to replace it, but she's pretty confident that won't happen.
So in the end, this is just lowering the bar so that people aren't turned away because of some small fines. They're not sort of reluctant to go back to the library to deal with this.
Yeah, exactly. This is all about bringing more people and regular patrons who just may have a late fine back into the library without any shame or embarrassment.
You have another story this week. There was a bit of a dust-up on a Steamship Authority bus after a passenger complained because the driver was playing conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh loudly on the radio.
Yeah, Vineyarder Beth O'Connor was on one of the buses that go from Woods Hole to the Palmer Avenue lot. And while she was on the bus, she said that there was she couldn't tell if it was the radio or if it was a small personal radio, but the bus driver had Rush Limbaugh radio on the bus. And as many people know, Rush Limbaugh is a conservative radio host. He's a pretty big Trump supporter. He's been heavily critical of the Ukraine investigation and the Robert Mueller investigation. During the radio segment, he was discrediting a lot of the people that were testifying at the impeachment hearings, and it was making Beth O'Connor uncomfortable. And so she had asked for it to, if this was the bus driver playing this, and the bus driver, she said he got worked up and was upset and was calling her a liberal and saying that she was violating his First Amendment rights. They kind of got into an argument, and another SSA employee told the bus driver, leave her alone, change the radio. And it turns out that SSA spokesman Sean Driscoll told the Times that the SSA actually tries to keep a political atmosphere on their buses and their ferries. And actually, at a board meeting in January of 2018, Steve Sayers, who was general counsel, told the board members that they would stop playing news channels like Fox News, CNN, and PBS on their vessels. They would keep local, local news and sports, but they would keep anything out that would be, political.
That is Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
A flurry of activity this week on Beacon Hill as lawmakers scrambled to finish up a slate of bills before the Thanksgiving recess. They passed a landmark education bill, took up a ban on flavored tobacco, and much more. WCAI's Catherine Ident has the roundup of State House action with our State House reporter, Mike Dean.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
So much to talk about. We probably won't get to all of it, but let's get to the big one right away, and that's the education bill. Lawmakers got it through. Tell us about it. Did it change much from when it was first announced?
So this is something that the House and the Senate kind of pre-conferenced, as we would say up here. That means that the Senate president and the Speaker of the House, with their education chairman, made a deal before the bill was even filed as to what they wanted to see it look like. Then it went to the chambers, then it got tweaked and debated, and then kind of reconciled between the two. But in the end, for the most part, it does look an awful lot like that agreement between DeLeo, the House Speaker, and Karen Spilka, the Senate president. It's $1.5 billion into the local education system, two districts, as aid over 7 years. And this is really what districts have been complaining about for years and years and years now, saying that they can't keep up with the rising costs of special education and the costs of educating English language learners and lower income students, and that the state needed to pony up its side of things. That's finally done. It's taken years and years and years, but those recommendations have been fulfilled. And over the next couple of school years, you're going to see a surge in money from the state going to local schools.
So this was done at the last minute because the legislature is now kind of on holiday recess. But lawmakers also reached a compromise on the distracted driving bill that's also been languishing, not quite as long as the education bill. Tell us what's up with that.
Yeah, it's amazing what they'll accomplish the day before they have to break for the
deadlines.
Rest of the year.
Yeah,
they got an awful lot done last night, but that's because they had stacked up an awful lot to do. So anybody working on deadlines knows that feeling.
Yeah.
The distracted driving is something that passed both chambers months ago, and the House and Senate got into basically a logjam and a disagreement over how to deal with racial profiling. Basically, if we're giving police a new stopping power to pull people over with cell phones, then that could lead to more racial discrimination. So, the Black and Latino caucus and members of color and people from communities of color were weary about authorizing this new stopping power. Although everyone agreed that for public safety's sake, it's a good idea, they just had a disagreement over how to share racial profiling data from these stops. A compromise was made. There's going to be a study directed by the executive, by the governor's office, to look at if there is discrimination, and that will go towards Baker's desk. He's been looking for that bill for months, if not years.
Yeah.
So that should be law relatively soon.
Another bill, Mike, that we've talked about quite a bit that we've been watching this week was a proposal to ban flavored tobacco products. Did lawmakers get that one finished up as well?
They did. Both chambers passed their versions and kind of reconciled the differences very quickly. And that is now on Governor Baker's desk. He'll probably take a look at that over the weekend. And he's got 10 days to do it. So he's got really through Thanksgiving to make these decisions on what bills he signs or doesn't. The governor wanted some kind of vape regulation bill passed before his ban was up, which is, I believe, Christmas Eve is when the vape ban goes out of effect. So he wanted a law in place mainly to raise the taxes. This puts a 75% excise tax on vape products. So they'll be taxed similarly to what cigarettes are. Up until now, we haven't been applying that pretty significant tax to these vape products. The flavor ban is kind of a different issue, but still associated with youth smoking and youth vaping. I think a lot of folks from a public health perspective think that flavors are what gets kids to start. And that includes menthol cigarettes and vape products. So leaving only tobacco flavored as the only product for adults to choose is really the goal of this so far. And House and Senate really brought it pretty smoothly. There was only, Republicans voted against this, mostly on small business claims, saying the state was overstepping and asking, an adult person to not be able to smoke, the flavor of their choice was a bit too far for some of the conservatives in the chambers. Whether or not Charlie Baker agrees with that remains to be seen. So we'll see what the governor does. He could sign it as is. He could send it back and amend it. That would put the legislature in kind of an awkward spot because they're not back in session until January. So unless the governor signs it as is, you could have a situation where things get delayed further.
You know, one thing that we've talked about this fall that I don't think the legislature got to, transportation.
Yep, that got punted. You know, imagine that.
Chalk, yeah.
Yep. The idea was, in the House anyway, to do a targeted tax increase to go towards transportation projects, roads, bridges, the MBTA, things like that. That was probably going to be something like the gas tax, which has not been increased in a while, according to Democrats who want to see it go up. So that is something that is still very much on the table. Speaker DeLeo kind of cut bait on that last week when he said that there wasn't enough time, quote unquote, you know, before the self-imposed deadline here to finish that work before the end of the year, it being not even Thanksgiving, and they will resume work and talks on that in 2020. And that's a little bit more realistic to get a law passed anyway, because the Senate had longer term plans and they didn't even intend to take it up until next year in the first place.
And that is Mike Dean, WCAI's State House reporter. Mike, thanks so much for keeping track of everything that went on. It was kind of a hectic week up there.
It certainly was, but they got an awful lot done this week.
Yeah, they did. Have a happy Thanksgiving while we're at it.
You too.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with State House reporter Mike Dean. A group of international scientists and leaders in the lobster industry have finished a three-day meeting in Woods Hole. It's about a new data tool that could reduce the number of whale deaths in American waters. The tool could offer new hope in the long-time battle to save the endangered North Atlantic right whale. WCAI's environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff is on this story, and she joins us now. Good morning, Eve.
Morning, Steve.
So tell us about this data tool. How does it work?
Yeah, so basically this tool really helps us reduce the risk of entanglement for whales. It helps us weigh the relative risk of entanglement at different times of year and in different places against mitigation efforts like, modifying gear, things like reducing the number of lines in the water, making lines, with weak rope. So it helps us figure out something like if there's a whale in a lobster fishery with 10 fixed lines, how high is the risk for that whale of entanglement compared to an area where there are 10 whales, but one vertical line? Which area is higher risk?
So this could be used to make decisions about gear modifications that are affecting the fishing and the lobster industry.
That's right.
Explain, the lobster fishery is kind of pushing back against this a little bit.
Yeah, they're really concerned about the data. Because overall, really in the last 2 years, North Atlantic right whales have been primarily found dead or injured by entanglements in Canadian waters. So ultimately, flawed data or even just the number of unknowns will disproportionately impact U.S. fisheries as opposed to Canadian fisheries, which pose equal, if not greater, risk to the whales.
How is this tool expected to be? What happens next? Will it be adopted? Where do they go with this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the hope. In 2 weeks, a group of independent peer reviewers will deliver reports on the tool. They'll evaluate, is this version ready to go? Are improvements needed? One reviewer said they'll figure out, did we really miss the mark? But either way, we really need to be ready here on the Cape. These whales typically arrive here by late winter. But just this week, NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Association, announced an extension of the voluntary speed restriction zone around 42 nautical miles southeast of Nantucket, because twice this month, right whales have been seen here. They're here. They're coming. We have to be ready for this.
That is WCAI's environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That is our news roundup for the Cape, the Islands, the South Coast this week. I want to thank my guests at WCAI, Sarah Mises-Tan, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. We spoke with Bill Evel at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We checked in with Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times and Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, and heard from Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And of course, WCAI's Catherine Iden spoke with our State House reporter, Mike Dean. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.